next case is 96390, Matthew J. Lehman versus C.K. Wu, M.D., and versus the Ohio Department of Human Services. Ms. Bear.
Provision versus the special provision qualified for recovery against a third-party defendant when that defendant is in position. The Department of Human Services references in its brief Section 51.158, and then also references the definition of a third party set forth in 51.157. Now, that definition of a third party is a lengthy, detailed description which does not include physicians or hospitals. And it would be interesting to point out that that definition does include public agencies. Now, as I mentioned just a moment ago, the rights of subrogation by human services are defeated, and that is supported by various cases when the defendant, third party who is liable, is either a state municipality or a state employee, for example, who has had state immunity. So we would assert to you that looking at the definition even cited by the department in this case.
Did your research indicate the rationale and the reasons for the passage of 2305-2527 by the legislature?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was that?
That's an issue that has been discussed at length in this court. And the rationale behind the provision 2305-27 was the earlier medical malpractice statute. It dealt with the medical malpractice crisis dealing with increased insurance rates and healthcare issues.
Was there, in fact, a crisis at that time?
There's a variance of opinions on that issue, Your Honor.
The majority of which say no.
Well, Your Honor, in looking at the cases up until this point in time...
All right, getting off that, how about the rationale behind this statute?
The rationale behind the statute is to avoid a double recovery, which I would submit to you, and as I said at the outset, is why the facts of this case are so crucial.
Mm-hmm.
In looking at avoiding double recovery, that's exactly what would happen here if this case was sent back. As you know, this case was settled. There was a $2.5 million settlement that was reached against all of the defendants in this case, and those settlement releases, while they're not a part of the record at this point in time, included all past and future medical expenses. Now, Your Honor, looking at the language of 2305-27, that statute provides for a reduction of a jury award. There was no jury award in this case. And so we would be looking at a situation where there was double recovery. The plaintiffs have recovered by settlement.
Were the expenses a part of the recovery, the medical expenses?
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
Even though the plaintiff hadn't actually paid them?
That's correct. The medical expenses were paid for by the Department of Human Services.
They were paid for by the Department of Human Services.
Yes, they were.
And so then you provided in the settlement with the plaintiff a reimbursement to her or he, even though they hadn't paid for it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
There was a settlement release on both behalf of Dr. Wu and the Asheville County Medical Center covering all of those medical expenses.
And they specifically, the settlement, I assume, specifically stated that those expenses were covered in the settlement.
Yes, they do, Your Honor. And that's a very, very important point, and that is why the facts of this case are so important to the determination of the outcome of this decision.
Why would that be specified when they weren't due the party who was injured?
I think, Your Honor, because of the fact that there was an allegation by Human Services as to a potential rate of recovery against either the plaintiffs or the defendants, I think that is an issue, and that's precisely why we're here today. It's an issue, as you know, that there is different rulings in the Court of Appeals on this issue, and that there could be the potential for recovery against plaintiffs on these expenses.
And you claimed, of course, that the party who settled the case had a right to sign away those rights of the department.
Well, we contend that the defendants had the right to sign away the alleged allegations against them in the settlement release with regard to their claims for medical.
No, you said that the expenses were specifically enumerated in the settlement release that the monies paid for by the department were being paid to the plaintiff in reimbursement, even though the plaintiff had not had to expend those monies because it had been paid by another department. And you feel then that party had a right to sign away the rights that the department had of subrogation.
we feel that they have the right to settle with regard to the medical expenses, and that if there's a right by the Department of Human Services to the state to recover their subrogation claims, that is still available to them as against the plaintiffs in the case.
So did you say go get your money from the plaintiff who paid her for those expenses?
That's correct. And it's important to note, Your Honor, that included in the releases were not only past medical expenses, but potential future medical expenses, which there's no way for us to know what human services rights are or are not at this point in time.
Right.
And that is a remedy that is still available to the Department of Human Services. So in looking at the point that you raised here, what is crucial is that there would in fact be a double recovery in this case. Now, it is our position that strict statutory construction allows for our position that recovery is not allowed against a defendant, physician, or hospital in this case.
Well, there'd be a double recovery, but not a double recovery by the state. Sometimes it's a double recovery by a plaintiff, but this is a different party who would be recovering its costs that have not been reimbursed, and that, so I don't want to argue with semantics, but this is not the traditional double recovery issue, is it? It's a double payout by your client.
By the defendant.
Right.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. That's my position. So, Your Honor, we would ask this court, and we feel that even more importantly is the broad spectrum of clarification and looking at the statutory construction in this matter. We feel that while we feel that statutory construction allows for our position and prohibits recovery against the defendant, we feel that even on a broader scope, that this isn't an issue that needs closure. As you know, there are varying opinions in the appellate districts, those cases that follow the Holliday decision, those cases that do not. We feel that while that is an issue that has all common importance and needs clarification, that when looking at the specific facts of this case, it was appropriate to follow the Holliday decision, and the trial court's ruling was appropriate to be upheld. The other issue here, and my second point, is that the rights that the Department of Human Services are alleging in this case are rights of subrogation. The subrogation right is a derivative right. This court held back in 1989 in the Kempo case that an insurer or subrogee cannot exceed the right of its insured or subrogor. And that is a very important point here. That decision has been followed subsequently by various districts throughout the state, that in looking at the statute 5101.58, and it has been held, for example, in the Kozak case in the 8th District, that statute allows for traditional subrogation rights. That the plain language of this statute does not involve any independent right of recovery by the Department of Human Services. This is a derivative action only. Now, in this case, yes, there was a time period when the medical claims were pending. But at the point in time when the plaintiff dismissed their claims for all past and future medical expenses, the Department of Human Services lost that derivative claim. Their allegation that they are the real party in interest in this claim is only with regard to the alleged right of subrogation for the medical expenses. And I will point out to this court in its prior decision, the Morris case, that Morris stated that 2305.7, in order for it to be a constitutional provision, the Morris court here in this court, in Morris, it was held that a collateral source is to be deducted to the extent that it can be matched to the benefit that was received. And in this case, there is no evidence, and there was not even pending before the trial court, the benefits to be received, i.e. the medical expenses. So even under the language of 5101.58, there is not a right of subrogation. That derivative claim was extinguished when the medical expenses were released as stricken from the complaint.
Is there anything that the department could have done to protect their rights of subrogation?
Your Honor, I think the court, or I expect the department, did do everything that it could have done. It asserted its right as an intervening plaintiff, and in its complaint and cross-claim, it asserted its right against both the plaintiff and the defendant.
What didn't they do to protect their subrogation rights?
You know, I think that they have done everything that they can do. I think where the breakdown in this case is that for whatever reason, the plaintiffs in this case have chosen not to agree to any sort of resolution of these claims and had chosen not to participate in this process, I think that is the open avenue. If this case is sent back, that's the direction that it will go.
So the parties are open and free to ignore the rightfully filed claims of the department and say, well, go look after the plaintiff. We paid her for those expenses. It's not our problem.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think that in this case, it was very inappropriate for the plaintiffs and the Lamesons and their family in this case to deny any right to recovery and then choose not to participate in these proceedings.
The hospital was on notice, weren't they, of the claim of the department?
Yes, they were. But it has been the position of the defendants in this case all along that the right of subrogation was against the plaintiffs and not against them.
So the hospital had every right to ignore the claim of the department, even though they were the real party in interest for those expenses?
I don't think that the claim, with all respect, I don't think that the claim was ignored. I think that was the basis for the motion of the defendants to allow the plaintiffs, the human services, to be joined with the remaining plaintiff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baer. Mr. Byrne.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, I'm Ronald Byrne, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Ohio Department of Human Services. Appellant, or athlete, who respectfully requests this Court affirm the decision of the 11th District Court of Appeals. To do otherwise would allow malpracticing doctors to shirk their duty to pay for the damages caused by their negligence and place that burden squarely on the taxpayers of Ohio. As Justice Sweeney has accurately described here, the real party in interest for medical bills is the Ohio Department of Human Services, the payor of those bills.
If you don't get this from the carrier, you're going back against the plaintiff?
I'm not sure if you rule that we do not have a right against the defendants, I think that extinguishes all of our rights. Our rights to any money from the plaintiff would accrue only if we have a right against the defendant and it is determined that those monies were paid instead of to the department to the plaintiff. Now,
doesn't your subrogation run vis-a-vis plaintiff, the payee?
No. Our rights accrue through the injuries to the plaintiff, but our rights are described in statute against the tortfeasor. In fact, any settlement subsequent to the notice given to the defendant, tortfeasor, places them directly obligated to the department. There is language in the statute that says that the plaintiffs can be liable directly to the department.
That's
for failure to give us notice. We had notice. The department was a party to the case. The fact that the plaintiffs had withdrawn their claim for the medicals and then settled should have put the tortfeasors on notice that their settlement was not to cover medicals, possibly future medicals, because quite often settlements will reduce a person's eligibility. But for past medicals, the department clearly stated the claim for past medicals. They had a right to present those pursuant to the subrogation statute. Also, Justice Sweeney correctly identifies the purpose of 2305.27. I don't think it's necessary, although the department would concur that the crisis was exaggerated and not completely contrived, but it's not necessary to determine whether there was a crisis. The purpose of the statute is to reduce and avoid double recoveries. If the plaintiff does not receive the medicals and they didn't make a claim for them here, and the department receives the recovery, having paid for the medicals, the parties are made whole.
So the issue comes down to whether the plaintiffs got their medicals. Is that the issue? Yeah?
No, I think that the...
She said they did, and you say they didn't.
The issue.
Okay.
I don't think that anybody can read into that because the settlement agreement said...
Well, what do we do? I mean, how do we go behind the settlement agreement, I guess, is my question.
I don't think there's any reason to go behind the settlement agreement. The terms of that agreement were between the plaintiffs and the defendants. The plaintiffs are not here, and it's easy to point at that empty chair. They signed the hold harmless agreement as part of that release so that if we recovered from them, the plaintiffs were obligated to them, not to the department, that our rights for the court today against the medical tort fees. The question is whether 2005.27 bars subrogation actions against the tort fees. I think it's a confusion of the issues on where the plaintiffs are.
Because you're paying, the state Medicaid paid the doctor, obviously, didn't pay the patient. Is that right? Money?
We paid the providers. The plaintiffs never received a penny on the medical bills. It's not insurance where money was given to them to repay for bills they had paid or premiums paid. It was paid directly to the providers out of Medicaid funds.
Do you say, is this a statutory interpretation case? That's the way I see it, counsel.
Absolutely.
And how do you, can these two statutes be reconciled?
Yes, in fact, 1.51 requires the courts to construe the statutes that conflict to give effect to both, if at all possible. It's mandatory.
Can
they shall construe.
All right, but so how do you reconcile?
The last sentence of 2005.27 says that unless otherwise expressly provided by statute, there shall be no subrogation in a claim against a physician, diagnosis, or hospital. The preparatory phrase, unless otherwise expressly provided by statute, doesn't mean the subrogation statute has to provide that it's effective against the doctor or hospital. It means that the subrogation itself must be provided by statute. The language that precedes that last sentence discusses different types of collateral sources, different types of payments that may have been covered and may have been presented as part of the case. Not all of those would have a subrogation right by statute. And the last sentence addresses only if the legislature has provided for subrogation can it be a subrogation against a medical provider. And so it's easy to justify those and reconcile given the express language of 2005.27. When it comes down to statutory construction, the two things that are important to look at are the purposes of the act and the results. It's clear from this court's earlier decision that the purpose recognized in 2005.27 is to avoid a double recovery. 5101.58 is clearly to recover funds paid out of taxpayer funds on behalf of an injured party. The outcome, if you look at the appellant's version, is that doctors who commit malpractice, and in this case there was a jury verdict that held that there was malpractice. It was a breach of the standard of care. We're not talking about a pre-verdict. They didn't issue a verdict on the amount. They clearly held that the doctor breached the standard of care. That doctor is then, under their version, not required to pay any of the medicals because the award would be reduced by the medicals to the recipient and not allowed to the department. So the doctor gets a windfall. And as all of you are aware, the medical malpractice cases generally result in extremely high dollar medicals.
What do you interpret or how do you read this movement by them to dismiss all these claims, medical claims, the plaintiffs? What do you think was the motivation behind that?
I think it's a tactical move handled quite often to divorce themselves from the department because there's only going to be a set amount of dollars offered. The tort fees generally have some dollar amount before they go into a settlement. And if they divorce themselves from the department's claim, then they can describe those funds as for pain and suffering only.
But you were in the case as an intervener for your amount of fees, despite their dismissal of their own claim, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, until the dismissal on the morning of the beginning of trial. We did not participate in trial or even to the point of voir dire.
And then when they settled the case, you're in agreement with counsel that the settlement itself did specifically state that medical bills were included as part of the settlement?
The language was included in the release that the settlement was made intended to cover all medicals past and future.
And at that time, this your action in this matter was still alive. You were appealing and that sort of thing at the time.
Well, we hadn't appealed yet until they put on a final entry.
Okay, but they were aware that you were still actively pursuing your claim.
They were aware, all parties were aware on the morning that the judge dismissed the department that an appeal would occur. Either way, the judge ruled on the motion to dismiss. So they knew that our claim was still out there.
So knowing that this claim was still out there, that you were going to pursue your rights against statutory interpretation, they put a whole harmless clause in the settlement in the event that you prevail. Is that your interpretation?
Yes, Your Honor. The department's right to accrue against the tortfeasor. They were on notice of the subrogation pursuant to the statute. The statute clearly states that any settlement with the recipient does not alleviate them of their responsibility on the subrogation. They were aware of that. They were aware that the medicals had been removed from the plaintiff's claim. There was no reason to believe that they were paying for the medicals, that there was a hold harmless in the event that we did prevail. By privity, our actions are against the defendants, and it's their obligation to recover from the claim should be prevailed in or remanded.
For either scenario, if they actually meant to include all the medical bills, then and you prevail against the tortfeasor, they can go back against the plan and get the medical bills back. Or in the other scenario, they really never did include the medical bill, then they never paid them. There's no double payment anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. Ms. Bear, you saved about 30, no, I'm sorry, you have about 30 seconds.
Your Honor, just to briefly address the question that you just posed to Mr. Byrne, I'd like to put in perspective the time frame here. It was on February 24, 1995, that there was a motion by the plaintiffs to dismiss youth services from this case, and at the same time, a motion filed to strike from their complaint the medical expenses. It was about 2.5 weeks later that this case went to trial and those motions were ruled on. So there was not a situation here where there was a dismissal, or I'm sorry, that the medical claims were stricken from the complaint and yet human services were still actively pursuing the claims that they had.
Who moved to dismiss it? Was it the plaintiff?
It was the plaintiff, Your Honor. And also, I think that human services has made the assumption that maybe that there was going to be an appeal in this case. But I would point out that subsequent to the settlement in this case, there was an attempt to recover all or a portion of the money paid by the Department of Human Services against the plaintiffs. And as you know, they have chosen for whatever reason not to participate in these proceedings and to live by whatever decision is rendered based on our dealings here this morning.
You've used your time, Ms. Bear.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.